Chapter 28. D'Aulnay lived in a converted farmhouse of stucco and red tile that overlooked the historic old city of Aix-en-Provence. Skye had called the antiquities dealer from the train station to let him know she had arrived, and D'Aulnay was waiting at the front door when the cab dropped her off at his villa. They exchanged hugs and the perfunctory double-cheek kisses, then D'Aulnay ushered her onto a broad terrace that bordered a swimming pool surrounded by sunflowers. He seated her at a marble and wrought iron table and poured two Kir cocktails of crème de cassis and white wine. "You don't know how delighted I am to see you, my dear," D'Aulnay said. They clinked glasses and sipped the cold, sweet mixture. "It's good to be here, Charles." Skye shut her eyes and let the sunlight toast her face as she breathed in air tinged with the scents of purple lavender and the distant Mediterranean. "You didn't say much when you called," D'Aulnay said. "Your visit to the Fauchard went well, I trust?" Her eyes blinked open. "As well as could be expected," she said. "Bon. And did Mr. Austin enjoy driving my Rolls?" Skye hesitated. "Yes and no." D'Aulnay raised an eyebrow. "Before I tell you what happened, you had better pour us another drink." D'Aulnay freshened their glasses, and Skye spent the next 45 minutes describing the events at the Fauchard Chateau, from the time Emile greeted them at the front door to their madcap flight in the stolen airplane. D'Aulnay's face grew graver with each new revelation. "This Emile and his mother are monsters," he said. "We're very sorry about your car, but as you see, it couldn't be helped under the circumstances." A broad smile replaced D'Aulnay's grim expression. "What matters most is that you are safe. The loss of the Rolls is of no consequence. The car cost me a fraction of its worth. A steal, as your American friend might say." "I thought it was something like that." D'Aulnay paused in thought. "I'm intrigued by your description of the Jules Fauchard portrait. You're sure he was wearing the same helmet?" "Yes." "Have you made any progress with its identification?"
"A great deal of progress."
He drained his glass.
"If you are sufficiently refreshed, we will go see Wiebel."
"What's a Wiebel?"
"Not a what, but a who.
Oscar Wiebel is an Alsatian who lives in the city. He has the helmet."
"I don't understand."
D'Aulnay rose from his chair and took Skye by the hand.
"You will when you meet him."
Minutes later, they were in D'Aulnay's Jaguar, speeding along a narrow, twisting road. D'Aulnay casually wheeled the car around the switchbacks as if he were on a straightaway.
"Tell me more about your friend," Skye said as they entered the outskirts of the historic old city.
D'Aulnay turned off onto a narrow street between the Atelier des Saisons and the Cathédrale Saint-Sauveur. "Wiebel is a master craftsman," D'Aulnay said, "one of the finest I've ever come across. He fabricates reproductions of antique weapons and armor. He farms out most of his productions these days, but his own work is so good that some of the finest museums and most discerning collectors in the world are unaware that what they consider antique pieces were actually forged in his shop."
"Fakes?"
D'Aulnay winced. "That's such an ugly word to come from such a lovely mouth. I prefer to call them high-quality reproductions."
"Pardon me for asking, Charles, but have any of these wonderful reproductions been sold to the museums and collectors who are your clients?"
"I seldom make claims about the authenticity of my wares. Something like that could land me in jail for fraud. I merely imply that the item in question may have a certain provenance and let the client connect the dots. As the American comedian W.C. Fields said, you can't cheat an honest man."
"We're here."
He pulled the Jaguar up to the curb and led Skye to a two-story stone building of medieval architecture. He punched the bell, and a moment later, a short, round man in his 60s, wearing a pale gray workman's smock, opened the door and greeted them with a wide smile. He ushered them into the house, where D'Aulnay made introductions. Wiebel seemed to have been assembled of mismatched spare parts. His skull, bald head was too large for his shoulders. When he removed his old-fashioned spectacles, his kindly eyes were seen to be too small for his face. His legs were stumpy. Yet his perfect mouth and teeth could have come from a fashion model, and his fingers were long and slender, like those of a concert pianist. He reminded Skye of Mole from the English classic The Wind in the Willows. Feeble shot a shy glance in Skye's direction. He said, "Now I know why I have not heard from you, Charles. You have been otherwise distracted." "As a matter of fact, Mademoiselle Labelle arrived only a little while ago, my good friend. I have filled the time since her arrival telling her of your wonderful skills." Vibo replied with a self-effacing tut-tut, but it was evident from his expression that the compliment pleased him. "Thank you, Charles. I was just brewing some hibiscus tea," he said, and led them into a neatly ordered kitchen where they sat at a trestle table. Vibo poured the tea, then peppered Skye with questions about her work. As she patiently answered the questions, she had the feeling that Vibo was tucking her answers in tidy mental files. "Charles has told me about your work as well, Monsieur Vibo." When he became excited, Vibo punctuated his speech with a quick-spoken, "Aha," spoken as one word. "Yes. Well then, aha, I'll show you my workshop." He led them down a narrow staircase to the basement, which was brightly lit with fluorescent lights. It was basically a blacksmith's shop equipped with a forge, anvil, chisels, specialized hammers and pincers, all tools geared for the armorer's basic task, which was beating out plates from hot metal. An assortment of breastplate, leg armor, gauntlets, and other protective equipment hung from the walls. Darnay's practiced eye glanced at a shelf holding several helmets of various styles. "Where is the piece I left here?" "A special headpiece like that deserves special treatment," Vibo said. He went over to the suit of armor standing in the corner, flipped up the visor, and reached inside. "This is a mass-produced item. Aha! I have them fabricated in China for the restaurant trade, mostly." He activated a switch inside the suit, and a section of wall panel about 4 feet wide opened with a soft click to reveal a steel door. He punched out a number on the combination keypad. Behind the door was a room the size of a walk-in closet. The walls were lined with shelves stacked with wooden boxes of odd sizes, each marked with a number. Vibo picked out a tall, square case, which he brought into the workshop. He set it on a table and lifted out the Fauchard helmet. Skye eyed the embossed face and thought back to the portrait of Jules she had seen at the Fauchard Chateau. "A remarkable piece. Remarkable. Aha!" Vibo waved his hands over the helmet like a fortune teller looking into a crystal ball. "I had my metallurgist look at it. The iron used to make the steel was most unusual. He believes it may have come from a meteorite." Darnay smiled at Skye. "That was Mademoiselle Labelle's theory. Have you dated this piece?" "Some of the design features were innovative, as you pointed out. I would place it in the 1500s. Which is when the embossing of human or animal facial characteristics into the visor caught on. It is possible that the metal itself is much older, and that the helmet was recast from an earlier one. This dent is a proof mark, apparently made to test the vulnerability of the metal to a bullet. It did very well at stopping the projectile. Not so well with this hole. It could have been made at close range or by a firearm of great power, perhaps at a more recent date. Maybe someone used this for target practice." "What about the manufacturer?" "The helmet is one of the finest pieces I've ever seen. Look here on the inside. Not a hammer dimple mark to be seen. Even without the hallmark, I would know that there was only one armor maker that made such high-quality metal. The Fauchard family."
"What can you tell me about the hallmark?" Skye said.
"The Fauchard were only one of three families that founded the guild that became what we know today as Spear Industries. Each family specialized in a certain area. One family forged the metal, the other fashioned the actual armor. The Fauchards were the sales arm, which sent agents traveling around Europe to sell their wares. They were well connected politically as a result. Normally, they did not use their hallmark. They believed that the quality of their armor spoke for itself, which is why it is strange to see that they engraved their coat of arms into the crown of this piece. The helmet
must have special significance to the family. Madame Forchard told me that each eagle head stands for the original founding families, Skye said. Veeble's eyes did a quick flutter. You actually spoke to Madame Forchard? Skye nodded. Extraordinary. It is said she is a total recluse. What was she like? A combination of a scorpion and a black widow spider, Skye answered without hesitation. She said the eagle in the middle represents the Forchard, who came to dominate the company through death and marriage. Veeble burst forth with a nervous laugh. Did she tell you that many of these deaths were untimely, and the marriages were mostly forced to cement their power? Madame Forchard is very selective when it comes to talking about her family. For instance, she denies the story that they were powerful enough to instigate World War I, and had a hand in promoting World War II. Those rumors have circulated for many years. A number of arms merchants encouraged and facilitated the war. The Forchards were in the thick of it. Ah, where did you hear that story? From an Englishman named Cavendish. He also said the Forchards stole his family's process for making steel. Ah, Sir Cavendish. Yes, that's quite true. His family came up with a superior steel process. The Forchards stole it.
His fingers caressed the helmet.
Tell me, do you see anything unusual about the eagle design?
She inspected the helmet and saw nothing she hadn't seen before.
Wait, I see it. There are more spears in one claw than the other. A sharp eye, aha. I noticed the same thing and compared it to the Forchard coat of arms. The number of spears in each claw is even in the original hallmark. When I examined the helmet more closely, I found that the extra spear was added long after it was fabricated, probably within the last 100 years or so. Why would anyone do that? Skye said.
Veeble smiled mysteriously and placed the helmet under a magnifying glass attached to a stand.
See for yourself, Mademoiselle Labelle.
Skye peered through the glass for a moment.
The spear shaft and head are actually writing of some sort. Numbers and letters. Come look, Charles.
Darnay took a turn at the magnifier.
It seems to be an algebraic equation.
Yes, yes, aha. That was my feeling as well, Veeble said. I have been unable to decipher it.
A specialist is needed. Kurt said this helmet may contain the key that unlocks the Forchard puzzle, Skye said. I must get it back to Paris so I can show it to a cryptologist or a mathematician at the university.
That's unfortunate, Veeble said. I had hoped to reproduce this lovely piece.
Later, perhaps.
Skye smiled.
Yes, Monsieur Veeble. Maybe later.
He replaced the helmet in its case and handed it to Skye. She and Darnay thanked him and said their goodbyes. She asked Darnay to take her to the train station. He was disappointed at her decision to leave and tried to persuade her to stay. She said she was anxious to get back to Paris, but promised to return soon for a longer visit.
If that is your decision, I must respect it, Darnay said. Will you be seeing Mr. Austin?
I hope so. We have a dinner engagement.
Why do you ask?
I fear that you may be in danger and would feel better if I knew he was around to keep an eye on you.
I can take care of myself, Charles.
She kissed him on the cheeks.
But if it makes you feel any better, I will call Kurt on my cell phone.
That does make me feel better. Please give me a ring when you get home.
You worry too much, she said, but I'll call you.
True to her word, she tried to call Austin as the TGU train sped north. The clerk at Austin's hotel said he had left a message for her.
He said he had a matter of some urgency to attend to and would be in touch with you.
She wondered what was so urgent that he would leave on such short notice. But from what she had seen, Austin was very much a man of action, and she was not surprised. She was sure he would call her as promised. The trip from X took just under 3 hours. It was late evening when the train arrived back in Paris. She hailed a taxi to take her back to her apartment. She paid her fare and was walking up to her door when someone said in a loud voice, "Excusez-moi? Parlez-vous anglais?" She turned and in the illumination from the streetlight saw a tall, middle-aged man standing behind her. The smiling woman by his side had a Michelin green guide clutched in her hand. Tourists. Probably American from the atrocious accent.
Yes, I speak English, she said. Are you lost?
The man grinned sheepishly.
Are we ever?
My husband hates to ask directions, even at home, the woman said. We are looking for the Louvre. Skye tried not to smile, wondering why anyone would want to find the Louvre at night.
It's on the right bank. You are some distance from it. But it is a short walk to the metro station, and the train will take you there. I can give you directions.
We have a map in our car, the woman said. Perhaps you could show us where we are. Even worse. Paris was no place for drivers who didn't know the city. She followed them to their car, which was pulled up at the curb. The woman opened the back door, leaned in, then pulled her head out.
Would you reach across the seat and get the map, dear? My bag.
Of course. Holding the bag with the helmet in her left hand, Skye leaned into the car but saw no map on the seat. Then she felt a pinprick on her right haunch as if she had been stung by a bee. As she put her hand on the sting in reflex, she was aware that the Americans were staring at her. Inexplicably, their faces started to dissolve.
Are you all right, dear? The woman said.
I...
Skye's tongue felt thick. The thought she was trying to express fell apart.
Why don't you sit for a minute? The man said, pressing her into the car.
His voice seemed to come from far away. She was too weak to resist when he took the helmet case from her hands. The woman slid in beside her and shut the door. Skye was vaguely aware that the man had gone around to the driver's seat and that the car was moving. She looked out the window but saw only blurred images. Then a black curtain descended over her eyes.